so reads the second chapter of Isaiah. We take pleasure now in asking our brother Ken to address us, and his subject being, the handwriting is on the wall. Brother Ken.
Coming events cast their shadows before them. Coming events cast their shadows before them. This is a saying which is a companion saying to the title of our lecture this afternoon, The Handwriting is on the Wall. And they have essentially the same meaning, for in each case it is an attempt to express the thought that those things which are about to come upon us can be discerned. The impending event, which is just about on top of us, can be discerned by the signs which we can see around us, which are sometimes called the signs of the times. Now, the origin of this expression, the handwriting is on the wall, which incidentally is a very common expression among us today, I think you will agree that it means exactly as we have indicated, that it's an indication of what is about to come upon us. The origin of this saying is in the feast of Belshazzar, who, as you will remember, was a king of the Chaldeans. And the story, which is found in the fifth chapter of Daniel, indicated that this man, Belshazzar, who was the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar, had made a great feast to 1,000 of his lords and drank wine before the 1,000. This is the way the story opens up. As he went on in this feast, and the feast apparently became more riotous, he went from one extreme to another until he was suddenly drawn up short with the appearance of a hand on the wall, a hand writing words upon the wall. And these words he could not understand. This hand came out and wrote upon the wall three words: Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. Or as it has been otherwise translated, Mene, Tekel, Peres. And these three words, which Belshazzar could not understand, troubled him greatly, because while they had come to a state of carelessness, he was suddenly drawn up with fear at this hand and this writing upon the wall. But he could not understand it. And in the course of time, one was brought to him who was able to interpret the meaning of these words, even Daniel. And he interpreted these three words to mean, God hath numbered thy kingdom and finished it. Thou art weighed in the balances and art found wanting. Thy kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. And so these three words had these three meanings. And of course it spelled doom for Belshazzar. And as we read on in this fifth chapter of the book of Daniel, we find that just as truly as the forecast was made in these three words which were written upon the wall, just as truly the end did come to Belshazzar. And we read, as we come toward the end of the chapter, these words, For in that night was Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, slain. And as we know, the city did fall, the great city of Babylon, over which Belshazzar ruled, together with the kingdom of Babylon. That great and heavily fortified city fell, and it fell to two men, two commanders, Darius and Cyrus, who were kings of, or leaders, generals at least, of the Medes and Persians, as had been forecast by the writing on the wall. I think many of us here, perhaps most of us here, would know the story of how Babylon fell, the fact that the river which ran through Babylon was diverted by the genius of Cyrus, and that the prophecy of the two-leaved bronze gates was fulfilled, the prophecy which we read in Isaiah, and that the soldiers who apparently were taking part in the revelry had neglected their duty and were not guarding these gates, and so the invading warriors marched in on the dry riverbed and in through the gates, much to the consternation of those who were inside the city. The memory of man is very short. And in this case, the memory of Belshazzar, the man Belshazzar, was very short. Because just a few years before, his grandfather Nebuchadnezzar, who had been a great king and a much greater king in his accomplishments than was Belshazzar, had been humbled by the Lord to the extent that he had recognized God. He had humbled himself eventually before God, recognizing the power and authority of God, and recognizing, in a sense at least, and to a degree, his responsibility to this great God who was ruler over all things. But by this time, by the time when the handwriting appeared on the wall, King Belshazzar, his grandson, had apparently completely forgotten the revelation which had been forcibly thrust upon Nebuchadnezzar. And so, feeling secure behind the great fortifications of the walls of Babylon, he relaxed and enjoyed himself in drinking and in feasting together with his friends, the nobles of Babylon. And he went so far in his excesses that he partook of, or he commanded that the vessels which had been taken from the temple at Jerusalem when Judah had been overthrown be brought out so that they might be used in this feast. And we read in the third verse of this chapter, "Then they brought the golden vessels that were taken out of the temple of the house of God which was at Jerusalem, and the king and his princes and his wives and his concubines drank in them." And so these vessels, which had been established for the service in the temple as part of the worship of the Most High God, were being desecrated by this king, and I think we can fairly say by this time, by this drunken king. They were desecrated. Now, the creature, man, should never for a moment fail to recognize and revere his Creator. This is axiomatic if we stop to think of it. Because if we are among that which has been created, we have a debt to the one who has created us. And he should be recognized. And his authority should be recognized constantly and never forgotten. And whether a man is lowly and a serf, or whether he comes to be king, relative to God, the great creator of all things and all peoples, he is as nothing. And not only should God be revered at all times, but those things which have to do with God should also be revered. And in this case, of course, these vessels which had been taken from the temple established for the worship of God at his chosen city, Jerusalem, were being desecrated. Now, in the course of creation, the great Creator created things of different levels. Man, we have often been told, has been the highest part of his creation. Of all the animals, man is the most intelligent. And man has been given the intelligence to recognize God and to worship him. Also, were created the lower forms of life, both of plant and animal life. And anything which has life within it is, of course, much superior to the inanimate things which have no life. So we could classify these things on three different levels, if we so chose: man at the highest level, and the other living things, and at the lowest level of all, those inanimate things, things such as minerals and wood and stone. Now, I think our very reason, apart entirely from any instruction we might receive from the Scriptures, our very reason would tell us that it is very foolish for that which is of the highest part of the creation to worship that which is the lowest part of the creation. to worship silver and gold and stone and things of that kind. To worship, intrinsic within the meaning of the word itself, to worship involves looking up. And to properly worship, a man must look up to something which is superior to himself. Now these people, these Chaldeans, were not doing that. They were not doing that. For in the succeeding verse, in the fourth verse, we read, they drank wine and praised the gods of gold and of silver, of brass, of iron, of wood, and of stone. So we find this intelligent creature, man, in this case, worshipping those inanimate things of the metals, some of which are regarded as precious and some not, and wood and stone. They were worshipping the gods of gold and of silver, of brass, of iron, of wood, and of stone. This is both ridiculous and degrading. And even those metals which are called precious metals are precious only because man has ascribed to them a false set of values, and they actually are not as useful as other things, other metals such as iron and copper. So to worship such things as these is indeed very, very foolish. Now, of course, these metals are often used to engrave beautiful things, vessels of one kind or another, and in some cases, idols, actually. And whenever this happens, and of course the precious metals are more often used, the metals of gold and silver, because they work more easily and because they do not tarnish as readily. But actually, when this happens, man is worshiping not only these metals, but his own creation, because he is, in a sense, worshipping the product of his own cleverness, his artistic design, the cleverness of his hands, the imagination of his mind and his heart. And when this happens, these things, which are a combination of the metals and the application of man's skills, these things displace God. And this is idolatry. And this is evil. And coupled with this comes the element of pride. When man becomes proud of his achievement, and he begins to feel that there's nothing really superior to himself, he is worshiping the works of his own hands. And so pride has replaced humility. And this was Belshazzar's problem. This is why he fell into this fault. Because as we read in the 22nd and 23rd verses, it states this concerning Belshazzar: thou his son, referring to the fact that he was a descendant of Nebuchadnezzar, thou his son, O Belshazzar, hast not humbled thine heart, though thou knewest all this. He knew all that had gone before to Nebuchadnezzar. Though thou knewest all this, but hast lifted up thyself against the Lord of heaven. Now the creator of the heavens and the earth had been insulted. He had been insulted by this kind of action and by this careless action. The memory of Belshazzar was indeed short, and he came to a short and sudden end. Well, the memory of men have been short throughout all the history of men, and we could cite a number of examples. You will remember particularly that when the children of Israel were taken out of Egypt by their Savior, God, with Moses as their leader, that a great miracle on their behalf was worked. But it seems to have been only a matter of days until they forgot that they had been saved by the strong arm of God. And we find them murmuring and rebelling against Moses and against God in the wilderness. And in the course of a few months, they came to Sinai, where great revelations were given unto them, miracles performed, and the law given, God's law given to them through Moses. And they were organized from a mob into quite a great nation for those days, in preparation for their invasion into the promised land, the land which God had promised to their fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And as they approached for this invasion, up to the southern boundary of the land of Canaan, and sent out the spies who returned with a somewhat unfavorable report, what happened? They forgot all the great things that God had done for them, and they rebelled against him and refused to enter into the land. And so again, we have men with very short memories, forgetting that they are greatly indebted to God. We are all greatly indebted to God, and these people at this time were particularly indebted to him. But it did not take them long to forget. Now, in connection with this, and the chapter which was read in your hearing by the presiding brother today, we have the same thought coming out again in the second chapter of Isaiah. Reading from verses 6 to 9, and incidentally, this of course was poetry written by Isaiah, and if we look carefully, we can see the meter and the emphasis as we read through it, even though it has been translated into English. And we read, "Therefore thou hast forsaken thy people, the house of Jacob, because they be replenished from the east and are soothsayers like the Philistines, and they please themselves in the children of strangers." I want you to note that the people Israel did exactly the same thing as the Chaldeans who had been their conquerors, or were about to be. "Their land also is full of silver and gold, neither is there any end of their treasures. Their land also is full of horses, neither is there any end of their chariots. Their land also is full of idols. They worship the work of their own hands, that which their own fingers have made. And the mean man boweth down, and the great man humbleth himself," to these idols, of course. "Therefore, forgive them not." And so Israel, who had been established in the promised land by the Lord, in turn forgot the Lord, turned away from him to the worshiping of idols. Israel had turned to idolatry. And since they turned away from God, God left them to their own devices and to their conquerors, of whom the Chaldeans were one. And this, of course, leads up to this incident when these Jewish peoples were in Babylon at the time of Belshazzar's feast. And this afternoon, we are talking at some length about what happened many, many centuries ago. And why should we labor these things? This goes back into the period where men were guilty of worshiping idols, idolatry. This is a long time ago, and civilization has increased greatly and advanced greatly. And most people today feel much superior to the simple people who lived in those days. But my friends, the memory of man is still very short today. And it is made shorter by the abundance of the material blessings which we have around us today. Just an hour or so ago, we had a brother who figuratively stood upon the wall and blew the trumpet and sounded the warning against those things which are likely to trap us and are trapping us today. And by coincidence, because there was no collusion, this talk this afternoon is in similar vein. The memory of man, I speak particularly of the memory of man for the great things which God has done on our behalf, is made shorter by the abundance of material blessings which we have showered upon us in this age, and particularly in these countries, and I mean by that the countries of the United States and Canada, both of whom have been greatly blessed with prosperity and ease. Now, this prosperity and ease do detract from man's attention to the things of God. They insert themselves into our minds, so that we are surrounded today by wealth and great abundance, and an abundance particularly of material things which have been created by the skill of man. And if we think about these a little bit, we can see how parallel many of these things are to that which was being enjoyed in Babylon at the height of their prosperity, and also in Judah and in Israel previously, out of the blessings of God. And the people, in their prosperity, forgot God. And if there is any danger today which is more outstanding than the many dangers which surround us, in my opinion, this is the danger. This is the greatest danger which we have. Our American economies are burgeoning with the abundance of material things. We have an abundance of cars and good homes and television and telephones and fine clothing and household utensils, refrigerators and vacuum cleaners and floor polishers ad infinitum, so that there's no shortage. And this applies to almost everyone. The poorest person today, not quite, but among those who are relatively poor today, there exists a way of living which is superior to those of the kings and the nobility a couple of hundred years ago. So we are indeed wealthy. And all of these things, all of these material things, are clamoring for attention. And our minds are directed toward the accumulation of them. We are being encouraged to covet. We are being encouraged to covet those things which we do not already have, and we already have many of them, perhaps most of them, but we're being encouraged constantly to covet more, to the point where the skillful advertising which is planned for us by high-powered organizations who employ psychologists in order to be more insidious in their appeals are deliberately attempting to make us dissatisfied with what we have in order that we might spend our money to buy more of their goods. And this is the kind of conditions in which we live, and you all know this without me telling you this. But it is perhaps profitable from time to time to stop and think about these things and think of what they might be doing to us, because they might be doing some things which are very adverse to our spiritual welfare and our future life. Perhaps some of you noticed that the man in charge of the culture and education for Jewish peoples in America recently came out with a statement that he thought the Ten Commandments were now obsolete, at least in part, and the parts which he had particular reference to were the two commandments, thou shalt not covet, and thou shalt honor thy father and thy mother, that the days may be long in the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. And he said these were obsolete because if we stopped coveting, then our economy would run down, because this is what keeps it going. And on the other commandment about honoring father and mother, it's hardly worth commenting on. But it's an indication that they're willing to set aside this thought of coveting, or the detrimental aspect of coveting, in order to forget it and go on to greater and more abundant living, even the Jewish people. But my friends, we, instead of coveting more than we already have, we should be counting our blessings. We should be thanking God continually for the abundance which we now have and which we have already received. But we are not doing so in our modern economies. We are not doing that. We are striving and struggling to acquire more and more. And in this very striving and this certain amount of dissatisfaction within us, we have that which obliterates thankfulness and gratitude to the Lord. And from time to time, I think each and every one of us must check ourselves up, realizing that we are forgetting. We are forgetting to thank God for that which we already have. Because if we become too seriously involved in these things, in these ambitions to acquire more, and if we set our hearts to acquire these things, these attractive material things, then we can be guilty of a form of modern idolatry. We can indeed be. Now, it is manifest that any group, and certainly a group of this size, has people who have talents of different proportions and in different numbers, and who have acquired a different amount, let's say, of material wealth or material goods. So how do we reconcile these things? Well, in first place, those who have those extra talents and those extra goods have along with it a very decided extra responsibility, which is a serious responsibility. We must never forget that we have these things, as it were, in trust. These are things which God has given us for a very short time and which should be used to further God's purpose and not for our own self-satisfaction. And another thing which I think is a criterion in this respect, we should stop to think once in a while how we would feel if everything that we have of such a nature were taken away from us. Because if we were completely decimated and downcast, having lost these material things so that we could not go on, and we realize that this is the case, then there's something not right about our heart, and we better change this. Because I don't think there's any doubt that a man such as David, who was, of course, wealthy and powerful because of the blessings which God gave to him, did not change his heart toward God. And regardless of the fact that he possessed these things, his heart remained right with God, so that God said he was a man after his own heart. But we should realize that we can slip into an attitude of mind which is very closely akin to idolatry if we set the acquisition and the possession of these things on too high a pedestal. Now, coupled with this danger and this insidious effort on the part of the merchants of this time to encourage us to acquire more and more of these things and so become covetous, coupled with this danger is another danger which we have in our modern society, and that is the desire for security. And the desire for security is almost acute today. We're very deeply concerned in this civilization of ours today, in this society in which we live, we're very deeply concerned about security. So you hear a great deal of discussions and you read much in the papers about things like pensions and Medicare and the best place to make your investment so you'll have an income a little later on, if you're not able to work. These things occupy a great deal of time and thought. But the more secure we feel, the less room or need there is for faith. And in spite of all this, there isn't any security anyway in these things. And I think you know this. Let us turn to that example which Jesus gave in the 12th chapter of Luke. And I want to relate this, as we read it, to the way in which Belshazzar was thinking when he held his great feast. Don't forget that he was sitting in behind fortifications which were considered to be impregnable, could not be taken. He felt secure. And feeling secure, he became careless. Now, reading from the 12th chapter of Luke, commencing at verse 16, "And he spake a parable unto them, saying, The ground of a certain rich man brought forth plentifully, and he thought within himself, saying, What shall I do, because I have no room where to bestow my fruits? He had an abundant crop. And he said, This will I do, I will pull down my barns and will build greater, and there will I bestow all my fruits and my goods. And I will say to my soul, Soul, thou hast much goods laid up for many years. Take thine ease, eat, drink, and be merry. But God said unto him, Thou fool, this night thy soul shall be required of thee. Then who shall these things be which thou hast provided? And so this man who had his barns full felt that his future security was taken care of. And if we have a pension plan and savings in the bank and investments to the point where we too feel that our future is secured, we can feel very much like the man with the full barn. Very much like it. And we too could be guilty of saying, soul, take thine ease. And yet again, even though we may be in a fortunate position concerning those things which we have been given of the Lord, we must never slip into this attitude of mind. Belshazzar was not secure in spite of his fortifications and his wealth. And this Israelite was not secure because in that very night, in each case, their life was required, and undoubtedly it was required by the Lord. Let us bring this thinking closer to home. This is a quotation from United States Senator William Fulbright from his speech on prospects for the West. And he writes as follows. Surely there is an excessive imbalance in a federal budget which allocates 62% of the taxpayers' money to defense and space, 6% to the agricultural economy, 6% to benefits for war veterans, and 10% to interest on a national debt consisting largely of costs of old wars, leaving only 16% for everything else, for public welfare, and for all the things that make America a better place in which to live, among which education is counted for an insignificant pittance. This allocation of priorities, in my opinion, is a recipe for disaster. And so, my friends, living in this abundant economy of which we are a part, and feeling grateful, happy, self-satisfied, complacent perhaps, because we are in so much better condition than those of many other lands, we are faced with a situation which has been described by Senator Fulbright. And he talks about something being wrong with the allocation of the taxpayer's dollar and the imbalance which is taking place in the way it is being spent. And if we add some of these things together, we soon find that 78% of the tax dollar is going to defense, space, and war debts. And that only leaves 22% for anything which might be properly regarded as constructive work. Senator Fulbright says this is a recipe for disaster. Coupled with this, and of course a great part of it, is this great race of armaments and the money that's being, the billions that are being poured out into the acquisition and establishment of missiles, which really aren't a defense, they're a counter-deterrent, we are told, and they involve such things as the Atlas missile and the Nike and the Minuteman and the Polaris, coupled with the atomic submarines, and the figures that are involved, the money being spent on these is almost astronomical. And yet, as Fulbright says, there really isn't security even in this. But we see in all this a desperate striving for security, and we know it's going on. And this security is being based upon a dependence on man's own creativeness for his defense. Oh yes, we hear reference to God once in a while. We heard quite a bit of reference to it at the assassination of President Kennedy, and I was impressed by how often the American leaders referred to the need of help from God. But again I say, the memory of man is short, and already we are not hearing nearly as much mention of it as we did in those days, and perhaps we'll hear less until the next disaster comes along. Let us look back again to Isaiah. Because here again we see a rather remarkable parable, or parallel. In the latter part of the chapter, we see here a period of disaster being described, a period when disaster is imminent. Don't forget, we're talking about the handwriting on the wall. And the things which we are talking about now are that handwriting on the wall, which surrounds us today. Enter into the rock, and hide thee in the dust for fear of the Lord, and for the glory of his majesty. The lofty looks of man shall be humbled, and the haughtiness of men shall be bowed down, and the Lord alone shall be exalted in that day. For the day of the Lord of hosts shall be upon every one that is proud and lofty, and upon every one that is lifted up, and he shall be brought low. And upon all the cedars of Lebanon that are high and lifted up, and upon all the oaks of Bashan, and upon all the high mountains, and upon all the hills that are lifted up, and upon every high tower, and upon every fenced wall. And so he goes on. Isaiah goes on to write and describe these things. And again referring to idolatry, and the idols he shall utterly abolish, and they shall go into the holes of the rocks and into the caves of the earth, for fear of the Lord, and for the glory of his majesty, when he ariseth to shake terribly the earth. Now, anyone who is acquainted with Christadelphians will know that they spend quite a bit of time on trying to discern the times of the time, the signs of the times. And we were mentioning a few things today which are in that category. And if you attend the meetings of any Christadelphian group holding public lectures, you will hear a great deal more of these things. The future is dark for the world. There's no question about that. And whether you're a religious person or not, it is agreed that the future is dark for the world. But contrarywise, the future is bright for the individual. The future is bright for the individual who will place his faith in God, who will turn to God, who will put his dependence upon God rather than on the ingenuity of man. Now, this is not easy. It is not easy, but Paul, in writing to the Corinthians, stated a principle which is something which should be a rule for each and every one who would serve the Lord. And this rule was this. He says in the fourth chapter of 2 Corinthians, and at the end of the chapter, the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal. Another way of expressing that is that all the things which are around us today, all the things which make for strength in man, can suddenly vanish away. And we're only too aware of that possibility today. We can't read the newspapers without being aware of it. But the things of God never end, because God is eternal and his purpose will be fulfilled. And if we put our minds on these things, we will be building up our treasure. And this treasure will not be wiped away. But today, we are concerned not so much with indicating that the end of things are to come here or there or now or then, but rather with the necessity for personal preparation, so that when these things do come to pass, and we do believe that they are relatively imminent and not too far away, when the end of this order will come and will be replaced with a divine order, with Jesus ruling upon the earth, when that time does come, then let us each and every one be prepared to receive the Lord. Let us realize that the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal. And put our minds on the eternal things. We should be seeking for the Lord and his wisdom. And if we have found it and embraced it, then all of these other things, whether they be homes or cars or refrigerators or clothes or anything else, will become very incidental indeed, because this great, high, shining hope will supersede each and every one of those things. The things which surround us today are indeed the handwriting on the wall. All these have been prophesied, All these have been and are expected by the true servants of the Lord who have been students of His Word. And they are the events which are to usher in a time of peace and righteousness, the time of security under the great and righteous ruler. And this will be the fulfillment of the desire of those who have been looking and watching and waiting for Him, and working while they are watching and waiting. And so to conclude, let us conclude with those beautiful thoughts which we find in the first five verses of the chapter read in your hearing earlier, which are indeed a description of that time. And place our faith in God and our objective. This should be our objective, that we take a part in this. And you will notice that in the course of reading this, the end of war is described, with the beating of the swords into plowshares and the spears into pruning hooks. And I'm going to conclude with a reading of it, but I want to mention once again that while the outlook for the world is dark, the outlook for the individual is very bright, because these things must shortly come to pass. And when they come, they will be the fulfillment of the hope of many who are watching for the Lord. And it shall come to pass in the last days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established in the top of the mountain, and He shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow unto it. And many people shall go and say, Come ye, and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, and He will teach us of His ways, and we will walk in His paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And He shall judge among the nations, and shall rebuke many people, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. O house of Jacob, come ye, and let us walk in the light of the Lord.
Thank you, Ken. We appreciate that a lot, your remarks, especially knowing the trouble you've had in getting here. But brethren, we've finally reached that point again. This particular presiding part of our gathering, I tried to get out of. When Brother Stone asked me to preside, said I'd be glad to, but let Brother Ben Cottrell have the last part of the service. I always thought Brother Ben was right good at summarizing, making a few little remarks concerning what we have heard, and bringing our gathering to a close. But Brother Ben, I understand, went to Florida. And so consequently, it's up to me to say a word or two to show our appreciation for all of the brethren that have partaken of this gathering in making it a success for us. You've heard it one or two other times, last night and this morning, that without an audience, there would be no need for a speaker, because there would be no one to speak to. So consequently, no matter who you be, what you had to do concerning this gathering, the very fact that you came and supported it and were willing to sit out in the audience and listen to what was being said makes you just as much a part as if you were up here speaking or preparing the food or whatever the job may have been. Every part of the body of Christ is necessary, whether it be the hand or the foot or the eye or the toe. It's a necessity. But the brethren have given us something to think about. I think you'll agree that the talks ran rather close together, but yet they all presented different thoughts. They quoted different verses. They had different chapters that were read. And though in a way they were all saying the same thing, they presented it in a different way. What one said may not have impressed someone in the audience in particular, but what another brought out, maybe it did, and vice versa. So in leaving this gathering, brethren, let's ask ourselves the question, just how much have you retained? I'll ask myself the question also. I have a note or two here that I've written down, possibly some of you have. But how have we been exercised by what we've heard? We have had a little bit of prophecy. We have been exhorted on what kind of a life we should live. We have also been given some very constructive criticism of weaknesses that lie in ecclesias, weaknesses that lie in individuals. And so to me, we've sort of had a rounded out thesis. We might say our spiritual diet has exceeded the physical diet that we had today. And so we could take this little blue pamphlet that we have here that was printed up, and after we get home, go over it. After we've had time to fill our minds with a few other things, after you have filled your mind with natural things, then reflect back and look at the different headings of the subjects and the chapters that were read, and try to recollect what you heard in the gathering. Because I say again, if we listen to these things from the stand, or whether we are standing down facing one another, regardless of where we hear them, but particularly we are at this gathering now, we have been exhorted. And if we are not exercised by what we have heard, then it hasn't done us too much good to be here. But in reflecting back, if we can recall just one thing, if we can remember just one thing that these brethren have said, that maybe it was new to us, something we didn't know, and we left with that one thought, it was of a prophet to come. If someone of the brethren brought something to your mind that you already knew, but it was in the back of your head, you had forgotten it temporarily, but he brought it forward, now you're thinking of it again. It was of a prophet that you came. And even if you knew everything that was said word for word before it was even spoken, you have still, along with myself, been exhorted to think more on these things. We just want to thank our brethren, Norman Smith, who spoke on looking at the signs of today, which went along with the handwriting on the wall that we just heard about. Brother Smith spoke on things happening of today, but yet they were recorded back here in a book that was old. That's a particular thought that we may not think about too much, but when we think of the age of this Bible that we have, the words that were spoken 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years ago, but yet they apply to this day and time. And Brother Norman also brought out how the young people should be exhorted on these things. It's not just for the older members. It's for the younger members also to take heed to these things. And it's your obligation and mine and every older brother and sister to see that the young people know that this book is in existence, that they can have a part of the salvation that you are looking forward to. And to give a little time each day, not just once a month or once a year, but give a little time each day, a little additional time, to get a little additional information that you might profit by. What did you remember about Brother Norman's talk? There are quite a few other things. Brother Paul, he spoke on Christ in you, the hope of glory, which also went along with Brother Trainer and Brother Ken's talk. Christ in you, it's very plain teaching as to how our lives ought to be as Christ's life was, that he is our pattern that we are to go by, that everything we do, say, and think should be to the honor and to the glory of God. That when people look at you, when they watch your actions and listen to your words, they can, as it were, identify you with the life that Christ lived as we have it recorded in the Bible. They can, as it were, say, he has been with Jesus, because he does the things that Christ did. He says the things that Christ said. He thought as Christ thought. And it all was to the honor and to the glory of God. We should emulate this high standard of godliness in the sight of all men. Brother Paul brought out quite a few other thoughts, but it's just, I want to refresh your memory and just sort of summarize, lest we forget these things a little bit too quick. Brother Trainer, as I said, went along with these thoughts that Brother Paul brought out, emulating the life of Christ. But yet, his remarks were a little bit different, because he brought out many of the things that we're at fault at. Places where we're, as we are, might say, are falling down on the job. All of us are weak. All of us need help. There's none of us that is free from doing or saying or thinking things that are not right. There's always room for improvement. And we are definitely keepers of the spring. And I believe one of the brethren mentioned it in a prayer this morning after the Brother Trainer spoke, that the main spring that we are to watch and are a keeper of is the spring that's in our own heart. Cleanse that spring. Get all of the material out of there that tends to pull us down and cause us to decay. And by keeping our own spring clean, we can then pass on a spring of life to our younger brothers and sisters that will help them along the road. Then, our last remarks that we just heard, which are fresh in your mind, concerning the handwriting on the wall. Old Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, his grandson Belshazzar, both of them having one thing in common, pride. Both of them lost the kingdom because of pride. And so, the things of this world, as it applied to them, they put too much trust in them. So it applies also to today. By putting our trust in material things, as we have heard much about, our pride and our haughtiness can be lifted up to where, as Nebuchadnezzar lost his kingdom thousands of years ago, we can lose the kingdom of God by the same kind of pride. Putting our trust in things that are of no avail, of no account to us whatsoever as far as our life is concerned. So, brethren, with these few thoughts, I hope that you have remembered as much, if not more, than I have. If you have, you will go away feeling that it is good that you have been here. And we want to thank all of those who have worked on the committees, the preparing of the food, the getting of the brethren to speak for us, and everything that made this gathering a success. And we hope that as you leave here today, that God will bless you on your journey home, and as it were, watch over all of us as we part one from another.